Chapter 4. My Kind of Town. Coach Jay did what he promised when I told him I wanted to leave Central Arkansas. He made sure someone saw me play. He couldn't have found anyone better. That man was Marty Blake, the NBA's director of scouting. No one spent more time searching for players with the potential to make it at the next level than Blake, and he didn't only go to the big name schools. He went to every college basketball gym in America, or so it seemed. One of his discoveries was Rodman. So what if Blake knew little about a player except for what some overzealous coach or sports information director might have told him? That did not mean they were wrong. How Coach Jay got Blake to show up in Conway was an example of how good fortune and tragedy, I suppose, can play a huge role in one's destiny. In 1961, when Blake was the general manager of the NBA's St. Louis Hawks, he was intrigued by J.P. Lovelady, a guard at Arkansas Tech. J.P. could shoot and played tough defense. On February 10th, J.P. had a big night against one of Arkansas Tech's conference rivals. 23 points, 14 rebounds. A couple of days later, he got in a car accident, which eventually claimed his life. Blake attended the funeral, where he met one of JP's teammates, Arch Jones. Fast forward to my senior season in Conway. Coach Jay called Blake, reminded him of how the two met, and suggested he attend one of my games. Coach Jay must have been awfully persuasive. On December 13th, 1986, Blake showed up at Southern Miss in Hattiesburg. The Golden Eagles were a much better team. They would win the NIT that season, beating us 95-82. I played well, scoring 24 points. More important, I scored points with Marty Blake. He was impressed I could play all five positions. I don't suspect he saw that kind of versatility often. Blake spread the word to teams around the league. You should come see this kid. He's got a real future. No thanks, every general manager decided. Every general manager except the Bulls' Jerry Krause. Jerry sent Billy McKinney, who had played for seven seasons in the league and was the team's lone scout. Jerry, who passed away in 2017, received a ton of criticism over the years, including from yours truly. There isn't one word I wish I could take back. At the same time, give the man his due. He could spot talent where others couldn't, and, like Blake, felt no place in this vast country was too remote. Exhibit A, Earl the Pearl Monroe from Winston-Salem State University in North Carolina. The Baltimore Bullets drafted Monroe in the 60s when Jerry was a scout. He was one of the first to identify Monroe's rare skills. Monroe, a guard, went on to become a Hall of Famer and one of the most exciting players the game has ever seen. McKinney came to Conway in late February of 1987 to see the Bears take on Henderson State. I didn't know he was going to be there, and that was probably a good thing. If I had known, I might have pressed a bit and not played my normal game. You can never be certain when your next audition will come, if it will come. I finished with 29 points, 14 rebounds, and 5 steals. McKinney was impressed, but not convinced of my potential just yet. Was I this good, or was the competition this weak? That's why the one-point loss a month later to Harding and missing out for the second straight year on the NAIA tournament in Kansas City felt like a tremendous blow. Here was a golden opportunity to prove to McKinney and other scouts who might show up, I could come through in the biggest games against the better teams. Anyone can get on a roll for a game or two. The top players bring it night after night, year after year. When I think of Marty Blake and what he did for me, I'm reminded once again of how blessed I have been. Wherever I went, someone believed in me, fought for me, gave me a chance as long as I did my part. Coach Ireland, Coach Wayne, Coach Dyer, Coach Jones, and now Marty Blake. I was a kid from a small town in southern Arkansas with nothing but a dream. None of them were obligated to help me, yet they did. Not only did Blake urge teams in the NBA to check me out, He made sure I was invited to participate in the Portsmouth Invitational Tournament in Portsmouth, Virginia. That's how much clout he had. The event, which had been held every year since 1953, included many of the premier college players in the land. Among those who have participated are John Stockton, Dave Cowens, Rick Barry, and Earl Monroe, each with his name on a plaque in Springfield. I was excited beyond belief. I was also nervous. Here was another new group of people to get acquainted with. They all seemed to know one another, having played in tournaments together since high school. I didn't know a soul. What if I didn't fit in? And what if I wasn't as good as I thought I was? What then? At Portsmouth, there were 64 players, 8 on each team. One who stood out was Muggsy Bogues, a 5'3" guard from Wake Forest. Kids today have probably never heard of Muggsy. That's their loss. He was remarkable. Despite his size, he could see the floor and finish better at the basket than any other point guard I ever played with. Muggsy was similar to Mo Cheeks. He thought pass first, score second, and would play in the league for 14 years. The two of us were quite a pair in Portsmouth. Darting down the lane, causing havoc, having a blast. Being ourselves, young and fearless. Both of us were named to the all-tournament team. A number of scouts and general managers went up to Blake in the stands to thank him for getting me invited. Among those impressed was Jerry Krause, who believed he had discovered the missing piece to help Michael Jordan bring a championship to Chicago. The Bulls would own the number 8 and number 10 picks in the upcoming NBA draft. Jerry, who missed his true calling, he was so secretive he should have gone into the spy business, tried, according to some reports, to keep me from taking part in any more pre-draft tournaments. He was afraid other general managers would come to the same conclusion he had. One report indicated he had been willing to pay for me to go on a vacation instead. I can't confirm a thing, although knowing Jerry, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. To stop auditioning at this point wasn't an option. The more I played, the better my chances were of going higher in the draft. Prior to Portsmouth, the speculation was I would be selected in the later rounds. There were 7 rounds back then, as opposed to the 2 rounds today. If my stock continued to rise, I could go as high as the 2nd round, perhaps the 1st. Anything was possible. The next stop was the Aloha Classic in Hawaii. I wasn't on the list at first. The way I performed in Virginia changed that in a hurry. The competition in Hawaii was fierce. Many players projected to go in the 1st round. My attitude was the same as always. Bring it on. If anything, I played better. I was named to the all-tournament team again and won the slam dunk contest. The prize was a boombox I brought back to Arkansas, along with more confidence than ever. So much for Jerry's hopes of keeping me under the radar. Not that he didn't try. He wouldn't be Jerry Krause if he didn't. One day in Hawaii, Fred Slaughter, an agent and friend of Jerry's, took me for a long trip around the Big Island. Why, I thought to myself, does this man think I might be the least bit interested in doing any sightseeing? I was here to play basketball, nothing else. Then it dawned on me what the true purpose of the tour was, to keep me from speaking to representatives from any team other than the Chicago Bulls. The scheme didn't work. I was interviewed by a number of general managers and scouts during my stay. At one point, Marty Blake summed up my appeal. Can play point guard and off guard and point forward. Great 3-point college range, can handle ball, has ability to become a star if he can handle the pressure, has a variety of big-time skills. After Hawaii, I wasn't done yet. Shortly before the draft, the top players got together one last time in Chicago for what was known as the Chicago Combine. I was looking forward to being back in the Windy City. The previous summer, I had spent about a month there visiting my oldest sister, Barbara, and a few relatives. I was blown away. Chicago was everything Hamburg and Conway were not. Large, glamorous, unpredictable. And being in Chicago, even for such a short time, sure beat building chairs and hoping not to get burned at the furniture factory. I felt a connection to the city from having watched Cubs games on WGN, their legendary play-by-play broadcaster, Harry Carey, firing up the crowd at Wrigley with "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" during the seventh inning stretch. So what if the Cubs weren't very good? Dad and I watched as often as we could. Those were some of our best times together. When visiting my sister, I spent many evenings on the courts at 63rd and Lakeshore Drive. A cousin who worked for the hospital picked me up when he got off work. We would be out there for hours. The games reminded me of Pine Street, guys unwinding after another hard day of work. One of the regulars was Dwayne Wade Sr., the father of the future NBA star. The dude could play. Could he have made it in the league? That's difficult to say. There was a vast difference between street ball and the pros. At the combine, I could sense something was different. Everyone was paying closer attention to me than they had in Portsmouth and Hawaii. I was approached by one agent after another. In the end, I signed with Kyle Roat Jr., the soccer player, and his partner Jimmy Sexton. The two would represent me for most of my career. I was comfortable with them, both living in Memphis a few hours from Hamburg. I appreciated their down-to-earth Southern hospitality and that they were men of faith. I could trust them. Each day, I met again with representatives from different teams. They wanted to know who I was as a human being, not just as a basketball player. Each team invests a lot of time and money in the player they pick. If they pick the wrong player, especially near the top of the draft, it can set a franchise back years. Case in point, Len Bias. In 1986, Bias, a supremely gifted 6'8" power forward from the University of Maryland, was the number 2 overall pick by the Boston Celtics, who had just won another championship. Bias would fit in perfectly on a team that had Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, and Robert Parrish. The future was set. Not exactly. Bias died of a cocaine overdose 2 days later. In mid-June, I visited some of the cities with the highest picks in the draft. That's how much my stock had gone up since Portsmouth. Jimmy, my agent, went with me. I didn't feel comfortable meeting everyone on my own. One visit was to Phoenix. The Suns owned the number 2 pick, which was as high as I could go. The San Antonio Spurs, choosing first, were set on the star center from Navy, David Robinson. I met with the Suns' general manager, Jerry Colangelo, and the former and future coach, Cotton Fitzsimmons, who was working in the front office. They asked the same questions everyone was asking. Have you ever used drugs? Has anyone in your family ever used drugs? What do you do with your free time? No one would have asked those questions if it hadn't been for what happened to Len Bias. The next stop was Chicago. The Bulls put me through a rigorous workout with Al Vermeil, their strength and conditioning coach, and brother of Dick, the ex-football coach for UCLA and the Philadelphia Eagles. In one drill, they put basketballs in different spots close to the foul circle. To determine my speed and agility, I was given 30 seconds to dunk as many balls as I could. I dunked quite a few. Being on the court for 2 hours, if not longer, I was starting to get pretty gassed, which was one of their goals from the beginning. Teams want to find out where your breaking point might be. If you quit in a workout, you are liable to quit when things get really tough, and believe me, in the NBA, they will. Better they know that sooner than later, before it's their turn on draft night. I didn't quit. That's not who I was. I was burned out, that's for sure. I had been playing basketball without any significant time off for months. I told my agents, please, no more workouts. If that means a team might hesitate to choose me, so be it. On June 22, 1987, the big day arrived. The site was the Felt Forum, a theater located inside Madison Square Garden. This was my first time in the Big Apple. I was in shock. I thought Chicago was big. New York was Chicago on steroids. After being stuck in cabs that seemed to barely move, I realized the fastest way to get around this city was to walk. I walked everywhere. I can't believe how naive I was in those days. Having never watched an entire draft on television, I wasn't sure if they would show just the first round or every round. Nor, as the moment approached, did I have a clue of which team would pick me. I thought the chances were decent I would be taken by the Suns, who needed a forward. The New Jersey Nets at number 3 and the Sacramento Kings at number 6 were other possibilities. In any case, it wouldn't be long now. Jimmy Sexton and I were about to leave the hotel when the phone rang. On the line was Jerry Krause, as secretive as ever.
"You can't tell anyone," Jerry said, "but I have made a trade, and you will be playing for the Chicago Bulls."
The trade had the Bulls agreeing in principle to send the rights to the number 8 pick and a second rounder in 1988 and the option to trade spots in the 1988 or 1989 draft to the Seattle Supersonics for the number 5 pick. I was excited. Chicago was my first choice. Only I didn't let myself get too excited. Nothing was official, and lots of deals fall apart at the last minute. This one, I didn't know at the time, depended on Reggie Williams, the small forward from Georgetown, being off the board. If Williams was still available at number 5, Seattle would take him, and the Bulls would be out of luck. Jimmy and I arrived at the Felt Forum in the early evening. I was dressed in a brown suit that must have cost more than $1,000. I had never spent that kind of money on a suit, on anything. The commissioner of the NBA, David Stern, stepped to the podium. Robinson went first, followed by University of Nevada Las Vegas forward, Armen Gilliam. The Suns picking Gilliam was no surprise. He played for one of the top programs in America. I didn't. The Nets then chose Ohio State guard Dennis Hobson, with Williams going fourth to the Los Angeles Clippers. Then it came. "The Seattle Supersonics," the commissioner said, "select Scott Pippen of Central Arkansas." There were no loud cheers or boos, only confusion. Who, many in the Felt Forum and around the nation must have wondered, is Scott Pippen? By the way, that might be the last time anyone referred to me as Scott Pippen. Before I knew it, I was being interviewed on national TV. Some guy, he called me Scotty, asked about the prospect of playing in the backcourt of a team that already had Xavier McDaniel and Tom Chambers as their starting forwards. I answered without letting on that it was a moot point. Jerry Krause wasn't the only one who could keep a secret. The deal soon became official. I wouldn't have to pretend for another second. I exchanged my Seattle hat for a Chicago hat and called home. One of my brothers told me Dad cried when he heard the commissioner call my name. Dad never saw me play basketball in person, which saddens me to this day. At least he saw the moment my dream came true. Now, I could get excited, to a point. To be drafted by a team in the NBA was a huge step, except it was just that, a step, with hopefully many more to come. Lots of players who get drafted never make an impact. I was determined not to be one of those players. I was a long way from where I needed to be physically and mentally. That's what pushed me to work hard on my craft in high school and college, and I wasn't about to stop now. The moment you stop working hard and become satisfied with what you've accomplished is the moment you begin to fall behind. There is no guarantee you will ever catch up. The next morning, I flew to Chicago, where I was formally introduced with a player chosen at number 10, a power forward from Clemson, Horace Grant. Horace and I met for the first time at the hotel the day before the draft. The two of us had a great deal in common, both from small towns in the South, Horace growing up in Mitchell, Georgia, which had fewer people than Hamburg, I didn't think that was possible. I saw in him the same hunger I had in me, the same work ethic. God gives us the talent. We have to do the rest. Our friendship would be critical in those early days. Both of us had entered a new world we knew nothing about. A more physical style of play, back-to-back games, long plane rides, reporters ready to pounce on your slightest mistake, etc., etc. There was so much to get used to about life in the NBA. As we grew closer, Horace and I would often greet each other by repeating, 1987, 1987. The year our lives changed forever. Chapter 5. Starting Over. I remember the first time Michael spoke to me. Okay, he didn't actually speak to me. He spoke about me. And he didn't have much to say. It was at the multiplex, the facility in the suburb of Deerfield, where the Bulls worked out for years. I had just walked into the gym with our coach, Doug Collins. Hey guys, Doug told everyone. Here's our rookie. He just wants to say hello. Michael was working out with two teammates, Pete Myers and Sadell Threat. Pete, whom I knew from the Dunbar Summer League in Little Rock, had been drafted by the Bulls in the sixth round the year before. He surprised the coaches by making the roster. I wasn't surprised one bit. I knew how driven and talented he was. All of a sudden, I heard a voice I recognized. A voice I would hear for years to come. Probably even in my dreams. Oh shit, we got ourselves another one of those Arkansas boys, Michael said. He didn't look at me when he said it. He kept shooting. I don't recall what I said in response, if anything. Knowing how reserved I was in those days, it couldn't have been clever. No matter. How I responded on the court would be the surest way to get Michael's attention, and that would be the case my whole time in Chicago. I got his attention all right, the first time we played against each other. He was guarding me as if it were Game 7 of the NBA Finals. I weaved into the lane and slammed it home with authority. I knew I couldn't allow Michael Jordan to intimidate me. As the details of my contract were being ironed out, I wasn't allowed to participate in any formal practices. I was frustrated beyond belief. Looking back, the delay was the first, and by no means the last, sign of how cheap the Bulls organization could be. Jerry Krause was trying to get me to sign for the money the eighth pick in the draft normally earns, not the fifth. The man didn't miss a trick. I worked out on my own for hours every day, which wasn't the same as being on the floor with others trying to impose your will on them and vice versa. With each practice I missed, nine in the end, I fell further behind in my battle with Brad Sellers for who would be the starting small forward on opening night. Brad, in his second season from Ohio State, was a lanky seven-footer who could shoot. He would be tough to beat. I finally signed for about $5 million over 6 years, four of the years guaranteed. Maybe not exactly the deal I was looking for. A deal nonetheless, and I couldn't have felt more blessed. This was my opportunity to play with and against the best players in the world. To live my dream. The money was more than enough. I would be able to buy almost anything I wanted, including a new house for Mom and Dad. They worked so hard for the 12 of us to have a better life. Mom especially. To be there for Dad and Ronnie and everyone else the way she was, day after day, year after year. The woman was a saint. In any case, the Bulls would take care of me the next time. Or so I assumed. I was the second player to show up at the next practice. That's how anxious I was to make up lost ground. The start of the 1987-88 season was only a few weeks away. 2 days later, we played our first preseason game against the Utah Jazz at Chicago Stadium.
When I went on the floor to warm up, I was blown away. More than 15,000 fans were in the building. I'd never seen anywhere near that many people in one place. The most we drew at Central Arkansas was a couple thousand, tops, and the crowds on the road were even smaller. Football was a big deal in Conway, not basketball. This was also the first NBA game I ever attended. The closest franchise to Hamburg was in New Orleans, where the Jazz played until the late 1970s, and that was roughly 300 miles from us. Might as well have been 3,000 miles, as far away as it seemed. I checked in with about 4 minutes to go in the opening quarter. We were already up by double digits. The first basket the Bulls scored, if I'm not mistaken, with me on the floor, was a dunk by you-know-who. I had a feeling I would see a few more of these from Michael before I was done. Though, to be honest, prior to joining the Bulls, I hadn't watched many of Michael's games in college or the pros. I was a fan, no doubt about it, and vividly recalled the jumper he hit in 1982 against Georgetown to win the national championship. It's just that I was consumed with my own game and what I needed to work on. Michael was where he wanted to be. I was not. I ended up with 17 points in 23 minutes, having success both inside and outside. In the next game, also against the Jazz, I followed up with another 17 points, as well as 7 rebounds, 5 assists, and 4 steals, the kind of all-around performance I would later pride myself on. As Phil Jackson and one of his assistant coaches, Jim Clemens, would tell me over and over, "Scotty, you don't need to score the basketball to be effective." The battle, meanwhile, was on with Brad. He and I were bringing out the best in each other. That was bound to benefit the whole team, no matter who got the nod. The battle was especially intense during practice. Practice is your best chance to make an impression with the coaching staff. In games, depending on matchups and how the refs call the action, whether they let guys be physical or blow the whistle whenever there's the slightest contact, a player can never be certain how many minutes he will receive. That's not the case in practice, where just about everyone participates. Before I knew it, opening night at the stadium was here. I was eager to show the fans the Bulls knew what they were doing when they made the trade with Seattle. Our opponent was the Philadelphia 76ers. I was sorry to miss Dr. J, who had retired after the previous season at the age of 37. The Sixers were still loaded, with Mo Cheeks, Andrew Toney, who could score from anywhere, and a young star in power forward Charles Barkley. How fitting it was that Mo, who everyone on the playground used to call me, was on the court for my first regular season game. The Bulls prevailed 104-94. I played a key role with 10 points, 4 assists, and 2 steals. One of the steals was from Barkley, and it led to a Michael dunk late in the game to seal it after we had squandered a 23-point lead. From there, the team took off, capturing 12 of its first 15 games to post the best record in the league. Coming off the bench, Brad had won the starting job. I reached double figures in 10 of those games and picked up my share of rebounds and steals. One of the victories came at Boston Garden. The Bulls hadn't beaten the Celtics in almost 2 years. My numbers that night, 20 points, 7 rebounds, 6 steals. I was most pleased with how I came through in the clutch. With us down by 3 points with less than 5 minutes to go, I stole the ball from their all-star center, Robert Parrish, and made a basket. I scored again on a fast break in the next possession to put us on top for good. However, I was still a rookie, which meant a few of my teammates assumed they could push me around. Charles Oakley, our 6'8" power forward, took advantage more than anyone else. Who was I to tell him to stop? On the court, Oak had my back. Oak had everyone's back. Whenever a player from the other team got too physical, Oak was in his face right away, and we greatly appreciated it, Michael most of all. He often got hacked when he was in the lane. Oak was Michael's protector. off the court was another matter entirely. Oak knew everyone in Chicago and went out of his way to make sure I got to know them as well. That would pay off in more ways than I could ever anticipate. Basketball and this privileged life I was lucky to lead would not last forever. The more people I knew in other fields, such as business and entertainment, the better. Meanwhile, as the months dragged on, Horace and I were becoming closer and closer. The two of us called each other 5 or 6 times a day and lived only a few hundred yards apart in the city's North Shore. We were the best man at each other's wedding, shopped for clothes together, went on vacations together, shared the same agent, and bought the same car, a Mercedes 500 SEL. Mine was black, his white. For the team yearbook, the Bulls asked, "Who would you take with you if you had to go to the moon?" I said the first person I thought of, Horace Grant. I don't know how I would have made it through my rookie year without him. Whenever I had a bad game, and there were more than a few, he assured me it was just that, a bad game, and that everyone has bad games, even MJ. Bad game or not, I was the same player I was the day before. Having Doug Collins as my coach didn't make it any easier. Doug was demanding of rookies. With Donald Wayne and Don Dyer, I was used to demanding coaches. They were exactly what I needed to help me get the most out of my talent. Except unlike those two, Doug was critical of me and my teammates in front of the fans. Like every rookie, I was bound to make my share of mistakes, forget to box out, throw an ill-advised pass, allow my man to get open, take a low-percentage shot with plenty of time left on the shot clock. The list was endless. The best coaches are critical in a constructive manner. They don't humiliate their players. They nurture them. They patiently explain one-on-one during a timeout or at the next best opportunity what the guy did wrong. Not Doug. Never Doug. One night against the Milwaukee Bucks, he became so agitated with me, he sounded like a fan. "You don't deserve your paycheck the way you're playing," he shouted. Everyone on the team could hear him. Every man, woman, and child in the arena could hear him. I could take it. That wasn't the point. It was about respect. Doug, whether he was my coach or not, needed to respect me as I needed to respect him. I knew better than anybody else when I made a mistake. I didn't need him to point it out to the rest of the world. For someone who was supposed to be on my side, he sure had a funny way of showing it. He was way too animated. A coach in the NBA shouldn't be running up and down the sidelines. In the locker room after the game, his shirt and jacket were drenched with sweat as if he too had been playing. None of the assistant coaches, and that included Phil, who was in his first season with the Bulls, challenged Doug, which was unfortunate. My biggest complaint was how much Doug was in love with Michael. He was more of a fan than a coach. Whenever a reporter wrote anything remotely negative about Michael, and granted, it wasn't often, Doug grew defensive, as if someone had insulted his girlfriend. I'll never forget the quarrel the two lovebirds staged after Michael walked out of practice, claiming that Doug had given the wrong score of a scrimmage. MJ insisted it was 4-4, while Doug said it was 4-3 in favor of Michael's opponent. No one hated to lose more than Michael Jordan. They made up before long, Michael kissing Doug on the cheek in front of the cameras. I thought it was disgusting for two grown men to act like that. "Pip, how long will Doug go?" Horace once asked me. I wish I knew. Here's the saddest part. Doug Collins knew the game as well as anyone. Of all the former coaches and players who moved on to TV, he was perhaps the most incisive. I wasn't surprised. When he put his mind to it, he taught me how to penetrate to the hoop and put defenders on their heels. He was an outstanding guard in the league before a knee injury ended his career at the age of 30. For someone so smart, he could say the stupidest things.
When my production slipped in January of my rookie season, mostly due to back problems, Doug questioned whether I had what it took to play in pain. I played plenty of times in pain, in high school and college. In college, I was diagnosed with a hairline fracture near my thigh. One doctor suggested I sit out the whole year. I didn't give it a second thought. I just kept playing. Besides, Doug had no idea how badly I was hurting. The pain was so excruciating that during the nearly two-hour drive from my home in the North Shore to the stadium downtown, I had to pull over several times and get out of the car. I would get this tingling sensation running down my leg to where I couldn't feel my foot hitting the gas pedal or the brake, nor could I sit up straight in a chair. I was scared, and this went on for months. Some nights, as I sat on the bench, my back bothered me so much, I prayed Doug wouldn't call my number. "Leave Brad in. He's doing just fine." I began to wonder if the pain would ever go away and whether my career was in jeopardy. When I told our trainer, Mark File, what I was going through, he didn't take me seriously. Worse yet, he spread the word it was my fault, that I wasn't doing enough stretching. Nonsense. I was stretching as much as anyone else. The Bulls could not have been more inept. The only diagnosis they came up with was muscle spasms. Muscle spasms? It didn't make sense. I knew what a muscle spasm was. This wasn't it. About a month after the season ended, I decided to seek a second opinion from Dr. Michael Schaefer, the physician for the Cubs. His diagnosis did make sense. A herniated disc. The way the Bulls treated my back situation was the second time, the first being the contract talks and training camp, when I wondered whether Chicago might not be the best place for me after all. I wasn't thrilled when Dr. Schaefer told me the news. At least now I knew what I was dealing with. "I've been saying there's something wrong with my back the whole time," I told File and Jerry Krause. "You guys didn't listen to me." They didn't say much. What could they say? My biggest regret was that I didn't see Dr. Schaefer much sooner. That is why I can't state emphatically enough how imperative it is that players coping with what could be a major injury seek a second opinion and not blindly accept the word of the team doctor. The team doctor is looking out for just that, the team, not the player and not his long-term future. Due to the disc problem, I was at 70% during much of my rookie season, maybe less. Some nights I felt as if I was 22 years old, others 42. I was taking my meds, a mix of muscle relaxing and pain-killing drugs, but when you are playing 4 games in 5 nights, the meds can't possibly keep up, and in our day, the league was a lot more physical than it is now. For the life of me, I don't recall when I first hurt my back. My guess is it took place while I was lifting weights, though lifting my dad and brother when I was in high school couldn't have done those muscles any good. If teams had been more cautious in the late 1980s as they are these days, the way in 2019 the New Orleans Pelicans protected their rookie sensation Zion Williamson, I would probably have missed a good portion of the season. No one in my circle ever suggested something to the effect of, "Hey, why don't we just take some time off to allow this to heal?" I wish they had. Doug kept me coming off the bench game after game, and it had little to do with how Brad Sellers or I was playing. It was personal. He was upset Horace and I were spending so much time off the court with Saddell Threat, a backup guard the Bulls acquired from the Sixers in the middle of the 86-87 season. Doug didn't mince words. "If you guys want to be in this league for a long time and save your career, then you better not run around with Saddell. That man burns the candle at both ends." Saddell enjoyed a drink or two. Everyone knew that. You could sometimes smell the alcohol on his breath when he showed up at practice. Yet he was one heck of a player. He could go from club to club the night before and still give you 15 points and guard his man as if there were no tomorrow.
Sadale would get so excited about going into a game, he used to hyperventilate the first few minutes. That, ladies and gentlemen, is known as passion, and I was lucky to have him as a teammate. I learned so much during my time with Sadale. He and another veteran guard, Rory Sparrow, taught me how to slide my feet to stay in front of my man. They were masters at that technique. Sadale was committed to his craft. That's how he, similar to Pete Myers, made it in the league after being a sixth-round pick. Doug didn't know what he was talking about. He assumed that because Horace and I hung out with Sadale, it meant we must be drinking as well. I would have told him that wasn't the case, if he ever bothered to ask. The other guy saw what was going on between Doug and us. One simple truth I discovered early on about life in the NBA, there are few secrets. "Did you stay out all night again?" Michael joked to Sadale during practice. "Now you got Pip and Horace hanging out with you too." Kidding around was common and essential. Except Doug and Jerry didn't see it as an innocent joke. They saw it as a sign Michael didn't approve of Sadale's behavior, and keeping Michael happy was always a priority. Doug believed he should be able to control how I spent my free time. He couldn't have been more mistaken. I learned after my father's stroke to make my own decisions. Those decisions included the people I chose to hang out with. I wasn't about to change now. Doug wasn't wrong to be concerned. The list is long of athletes who have squandered their God-given talents with terrible judgment and lived to regret it. Doug was wrong in the way he shared those concerns. Horace and I were grown men. No one had the right to speak to us like that, not even our coach. I knew my body and mind better than anyone else, when to rest and when to go out. It would have done me and the Bulls no good to stay in every night. With Doug, it always came down to the double standard he set. One set of rules for Michael, one for everyone else. He would never have told Michael whom he shouldn't be hanging out with during his free time. Doug deferred to him in every situation, on or off the court. It would make me want to vomit. Doug used to tell Mark File, "Go ask Michael what he wants to do." "What he wants to do? Are you kidding me?" I felt like chiming in, "Doug, you are the freaking head coach of the Chicago Bulls. You decide what we should do, not Michael Jeffrey Jordan." Michael, recognizing the power he possessed, took full advantage. If he had a commercial to shoot or a tee time to make, practice would be set around his narrow window. If practice was running too long, Doug would simply excuse him. The worst was what occasionally took place at practice the day after a game. "Michael, you got off today," Doug would say. "Go take a shower. Everyone else, I want you on the floor right away." His rationale for giving Michael a break was that he had expended a lot of energy in scoring 30 points or whatever the total might be. What Doug failed to take into account was that Horace and I had played nearly as many minutes as Michael did and would benefit from the time off as well. It also didn't occur to Doug that Michael was flawed like everyone else. On some nights, he needed to take 30 shots or more to get those 30 points. Spending a little extra time on his shooting couldn't hurt. Guys lose trust in a coach when he places one player over the rest of the team. I don't care who that player is. All of us were stars in high school and college. We didn't make it this far by accident. To now suddenly feel we were second rate was incredibly insulting. To Doug, it wasn't just about winning. It was about giving the people the show they had come to see. The Michael Jordan Show. No doubt some fans preferred that Michael score 50 points in a loss rather than 20 points in a victory. They could brag to their buddies by the water cooler the next day. They had seen the one and only Michael Jordan at his best. A more secure coach would never have given in like that to his star player. Can you imagine Pat Riley allowing Patrick Ewing to do whatever he wanted? Or Greg Popovich constantly deferring to Tim Duncan? Please. By favoring Michael, Doug stunted the growth of everyone else, including me.
I was fortunate. Over time, I was able to develop, mostly due to Phil and Tex and a strong work ethic. What about the guys who weren't as fortunate? Would their careers and lives have turned out differently? We'll never know. In March of 1988, I went through a stretch in which I missed 11 of 12 free throws. I was far from automatic from the line in the best of times. This, however, was inexcusable. No one could figure out what was wrong. I was to blame, needless to say, although not entirely. Doug and Michael were also partly responsible. In many games, I barely touched the basketball. As a result, I couldn't sustain any rhythm. Horace and I used to talk about how we would run up and down the court like deer in headlights, with no purpose to what we were doing. Why bother? The ball wasn't coming to either of us, only to Michael. I'm not suggesting I needed 15 or 20 shots a game. I wasn't a scorer, not yet. What I needed were touches. When I had the ball in my hands for even 2 or 3 seconds, I felt I was part of the game in a way I didn't feel when I watched Michael throw up one shot after another. I should have taken a seat with the other spectators. So when the ball did stop the presses, come to me, and I was fouled, I wasn't nearly as confident as I should have been when I stepped to the line. I finished the regular season averaging only 7.9 points and 3.8 rebounds a game and failed to make the all-rookie team. Was I disappointed? You bet. Discouraged? No way. Not when Doug kept me out of the starting lineup, not when my back flared up, not when MJ acted as if it were 1 against 5. Never. When I came to the Chicago Bulls in the fall of 1987, I couldn't have been more naive. I thought being a professional basketball player meant you practiced for 2 hours and got the rest of the day off. Since then, I had learned so much that if you are truly dedicated to your craft, 2 hours is nothing. You need to remain in the gym long after practice has ended to work on the parts of your game that need work and the parts that don't. Even when you don't feel like it, especially when you don't feel like it. The key is to constantly remind yourself that at this point in your life, nothing in this world is more important than basketball. That means making sacrifices, some small, some large, almost all painful. That's why they are called sacrifices and why most players don't dig deep enough. They might play in the league for 15 years and even be an all-star. Yet by not digging deep enough, they will never know how good they could have been. I didn't want that happening to me. That meant letting go of Karen, who had become my wife, and a son, Antron, who was born that past November. I still adored Karen as much as ever and was thrilled to have a son. I just didn't have the time to be a good husband or a good father. And the sooner she and I realized that, the better. The divorce would become final in 1990. I made a commitment to another family, my teammates, for which I have no regrets. We spent a lot of time together, on the road especially. For me and Horace, being rookies, this was the first time in our lives we had our freedom and the money to take advantage of it. That can be a very good or very dangerous combination. In our case, it was very good. And a lot of that was from being surrounded by veterans who enjoyed themselves, yet never crossed the line. In the last dance, the players Michael said he saw doing coke and smoking weed were gone by the time I arrived. Jerry Krause made sure of it. A couple ended up in rehab. Even Michael didn't drink in the early days. He didn't begin drinking until he returned from his first retirement in 1995. As for drugs, I didn't see any, I swear. This being the late 1980s, when drugs were rampant in the NBA and the culture at large, that said a lot about the men in our locker room. Gambling was another matter. We loved playing cards. On the bus, on the plane, at the airport, in the hotel, everywhere. The game we played most of the time is called Tunk, The key to Tonk, as it is with Gin Rummy, is to dispose of your cards as quickly as possible. There were two leagues, the majors and minors. MJ, it should come as no shock, was in the majors. He was always trying to bring in more guys to increase the size of the pot so he could break everyone. Oak also played in the majors. I went back and forth. Even in the majors, the most you would lose in any one game was a few hundred bucks, maybe a grand. In any case, it was never about the money. It was about ribbing each other and having fun. We needed to blow off steam. "You know I'm about to get you," a player would say. "No, you're not." "Oh, yes, I am." Playing cards was also an opportunity for Michael to get away from people who might otherwise approach him in the airport for an autograph or photo. You can't imagine how many requests there were, and that was before he became even more popular in the mid-90s. Michael and I got along well enough, though I could tell even then we were never going to be close. Maybe if we had played golf together with the Wilson clubs he gave me rookie year, it would have been different. I doubt it. He lived in a different world from the rest of us. It occurred to me on more than a few occasions. If this was what fame looks like, I don't want any part of it. Everyone, the folks at Nike, Gatorade, NBC's Ahmad Rashad, etc., etc., fussed over Michael as if he were the king of Siam. He was a basketball player. I made a conscious decision at the time, and not once did I regret it. I wasn't going to be one of those people desperately trying to get Michael Jordan to like me. Only by charting my own course and not relying on him for validation would I reach my potential as a player and, more important, as a human being. Being surrounded for as long as I could remember by 11 brothers and sisters who loved me unconditionally, I never felt the need to win someone over. They were my best friends then, and always will be.